In our ongoing consideration of the book of Genesis, we come today to what I consider to be the high point of the book. And I'd like to present this text to you, not in a sermon format, but in the first person. My name is Abraham, and I'm here today to tell you a story. Actually, it is the story of the most difficult time of my life. Before I do that, however, I'd like to ask you a question. What is the most difficult thing you've ever had to do? The most difficult thing you've ever done. Now, when I say difficult, I don't necessarily mean physically difficult, as lifting a heavy object off of an injured friend's leg. No, instead, I'm talking about emotionally or spiritually difficult, the hardest thing you've ever done. Was it possibly saying no to marriage because as much as you loved that other person, you knew they were not a believer? Was it giving the final orders to the hospital personnel to stop life support on a loved one? Was it saying goodbye to your children as they moved halfway around the world? Was it walking away from the cemetery after burying your spouse of 45 years? Was it watching a child walk away from God and knowing that there was not anything you could do about it? Was it saying yes to God when he asked you to completely change your lifestyle and your standard of living? Maybe entering into service as a missionary or taking a new job or even moving to an entirely different city? What's the most difficult thing you have ever done? Now, I wish I had the time to stop and ask each one of you that question and to have you think about it and then respond to it, because I'd like to ask you then, what did you learn through that experience? I have another question. It's especially for those of you who have not yet even thought of a most difficult experience from the past. This question is, what is the most difficult thing you think you will ever have to do in the future? If it hasn't already happened, there's coming a time when my experience, which I'm going to tell you about today, will be yours. Oh, the circumstances will be different, I suspect, but the difficulty will be surely as great. And I can assure you the feelings will be every bit as intense. And in that most difficult time, if you are a believer in God, then you too will be faced with what I was faced with. Do I truly trust God? I mean, trust him? I hope that you will have your own story in mind as I tell you my story of the most difficult time in my life. It all began, frankly, at probably one of the happiest times in my life. I had everything a man could possibly want. I had a relationship with God. I had a faithful wife. I had a healthy, growing son. And I had a very comfortable living. 40 years before, God had come to me and told me to leave the country of my father and my father's household and to move to a land unknown to me, a land that God would show me. God also promised me at that very time that he would cause to come from me an extended family, a great multitude of people that would become a nation in itself, and in fact, God said, would be a blessing to the whole world. Those were heady, exciting days. Those thoughts were far bigger than anything I would have ever imagined. But I must tell you, it stretched my imagination because my wife, Sarah, could not have children. So that was a huge step for me to take. In those days, transportation and communication were not what they are today. But I trusted God. I took Sarah, my wife, and my nephew Lot, and we headed out into the unknown. The next 25 years were a roller coaster existence. I say roller coaster for the obvious reason. It had tremendous ups and also tremendous downs. The downs were pretty severe. There was a time when I moved to Egypt and I lied to the king and I lost almost everything. There was the time that I saw Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed by the fire of God's judgment, and I was left wondering if my nephew Lot and his family would even make it out alive. There was also the time that Sarah and I stopped believing in God, believing that God would do what he said he would do, and so we took things into our own hands and into our own timing. And I had a child, not by Sarah, but by Sarah's servant girl named Hagar. What a spiritual failure. What a mess I made. But probably the lowest point in my life, up until the incident I'm about to tell you, is the time when Sarah demanded that my son Ishmael and his mother Hagar be sent away. Put out of our home, put out of our community, sent out probably to die. I'll never forget that day as I watched him, that is Ishmael and his mother, walk out away from our place with only enough provisions for a few days, not knowing if he would live or die. Those were some of the downs, but I want you to know in that roller coaster of 25 years, there were also some ups. God blessed us materially. In fact, we became what I think everyone around us would call simply wealthy. I remember the time that my men and I chased after other soldiers who had captured Lot, and though we were greatly outnumbered, by God's grace, we were able to defeat those soldiers and their kings, and we brought Lot and all of the others who had been captured back to our territory. I became something of a hero after that. And all during those 25 years, God kept coming time after time to restate his promise to me that I would become the father of a great nation with thousands of descendants. And each time, I would wonder how God could possibly do that since my wife could not have children. Finally, 24 years into that 25 years I've just been describing, God came very specifically to me with a very specific promise. He said, within a year, not simply sometime in the future, but within a year, your wife Sarah will have a son, and you're to call him Isaac. I want you to know that I was 99 years of age at that time, and Sarah was 89. And so clearly, the high point of our lives was when, sure enough, just as God had promised a year earlier, so now, a year later, Sarah gave birth to a bouncing baby boy. We called him Isaac. He was the son that God had promised. We had waited 25 years, and though we had often failed, God had been faithful. And as I said, except for sending my son Ishmael away, the next 15 or 16 years were probably the happiest years of my life. Everything we had dreamed about for 25 years had come to pass. We were in the land that God had promised to us 40 years earlier. We were prospering in that land. We had the son, a healthy son, that God had promised to us. The son that would be our future, and as God had said, would be the future of the world. The happiest days of our lives. And that's what makes what happened next incomprehensible. One day, God called out my name, Abraham. Now, I didn't hear directly from God all the time, but believe me, I knew when it was God. And so I responded like a servant should. I simply said, here I am, God. Meaning, I'm your servant, God. I'm ready to listen. I'm ready to do exactly what you say. The words that came next from God just reflected my own heart. For what God did in the very first words that he spoke was he talked about my relationship to Isaac. Here's what he said. I want you to take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. Now, he said more, but I was captured by those words, for God described my relationship with Isaac. He said, take your son. That's right, my son. This was not a son that came some other way. This was the son that came from my own wife and me, my son. And just as truly, it was my only son. Now, that was a bittersweet thing, the Lord said. The bitterness is in reminding me that I had sent Ishmael away. But the sweetness in remembering that this was indeed my only child. God further said, he's Isaac. Yes, that's right, Isaac. I named him that because God told me to name him that. The son of promise. All of my future, God said, and even the future of the world, hung on this son, my only son, Isaac. But God also said this, he's the son whom you love. And how right he was, for how could I possibly love a child more than I loved this son? You know what I mean? For 15 years, I had played with him, protected him, disciplined him, encouraged him, enjoyed him. What a blessing. What an almost unbelievable blessing he has been in my life. But the words that God next spoke were probably the worst words that I have ever heard in my life. This is what he said. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. I was stunned. I didn't know how to respond. I didn't know what to believe. For in one command, I was asked to take the two most powerful forces in my life and pit them against each other. On the one side is that love for my only son, Isaac, that I have described. And on the other side is my increasing commitment to obey my God no matter what. And in one command, God has pitted those two most powerful forces in my life against each other. You might say, well, God would never tell you to do that. I'm here to tell you he did. What I told you he said was exactly what he said. Now you have to understand that as barbaric as it might sound to you, it was not uncommon in our day in other religions for people to sacrifice children in their worship. I knew of that kind of practice. Furthermore, God later said that the firstborn of every family is to be dedicated to him. Dedicated to him. You know what that means? That means given to him for God to do with exactly however he chooses. In fact, later on, Moses would initiate a sacrifice of an animal to buy back, to redeem back the life of that firstborn son. So committed, so dedicated to God is that child. So my experience around me, that is the culture around me, and also my understanding of God's attitude toward the firstborn made God's command probable. It made it believable, even if it was astounding to me. Once before, I had been asked to leave what was dearest to me and to trust God. It had been 40 years earlier, and I had done it, but this was different. This was my son, my only son, whom I loved. I frankly cannot recall with any certainty what was going on through my mind, but I knew the command was clear and the cost was impossibly high. Early the next morning, I got up and I saddled a donkey, and then I called two of my servants to come with us. I don't even remember what I told them we were doing. I do know this, that my mind was in turmoil that morning. The clue should be this. I saddled the donkey and I called the servants to come and go before I had even gotten the wood that we were going to need for the sacrifice. I was clearly confused, as you could well imagine. Was I hoping God would change his mind? Was I wondering if I would actually go through with it even though I was starting the preparations? Or was I just crushed with grief as I anticipated what was about to happen? If you wonder how it's possible that I could have taken the command seriously enough to even start off that morning, then you don't understand what kind of relationship I had developed with God. 40 years. God had never, never failed me. 40 years, and he had rescued me more than once. 40 years, and he had made promises to me that absolutely came true. One of them was standing right there beside me. His name was Isaac. And the God who made the command to me last night was the very same God who had become my friend. That's how I could even entertain the idea. We set out, donkey with the wood on it, the two servants, and my son Isaac and me. 2 days we traveled, 2 nights we slept, or I tried to sleep, and all the time I was struggling with those two competing values in my life. My love for my son and my commitment to obey God. Those were the longest days of my life. I don't know why God made me walk 2.5 days to get to the place where I was supposed to do this thing. Did God want me to have plenty of time to consider what I was doing? Was that what it was for? Did God want to torture me over those days with the immensity of his command? Did he want to drive me to the very end of myself? Did he want to see not an impulsive action on my part, but a considered response to him? Would I obey him? Would I trust him even when I thought about it long and hard? On the third day, I looked up, and I saw the place in the distance. I knew from God that that was the place where the sacrifice would take place. And all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed, for what had simply been something that was going to happen was now imminent. And what was before that rather surreal and nightmare-like was now all of a sudden very, very real. And those last few miles were torturous. We finally got to the place, or to a place where I wanted the servants and the donkey to wait while Isaac and I would go on the last distance. And I told them we were going to worship. But I also told them we would come back to them. What was I thinking? What was I saying? I honestly don't know. Why did I say that? We, meaning Isaac and me, we would come back to them. Was I just telling a little lie to somehow keep Isaac in the dark? Was I planning to disobey God and I knew that I couldn't go through with it, so we would be coming back? Or was I expecting God to change his mind or do something else? I put the wood from the donkey on Isaac. And then I took the fire pot, that's the thing that contained the embers from the fire last night, so we'd have fire when we got to the altar. And I took the knife, and we made our final ascent up the mountain. Very little talking had gone on the previous 2 days, and now as Isaac and I walked along together, we were absolutely silent. And as we walked, my heart grew heavier and heavier. Finally, Isaac is the one who broke the deathly silence. He said, "Father," and I said to him what I had said to God earlier, "Here I am," or "Yes, yes, my son." Then Isaac asked the question that must have been obvious for days, but when he asked it aloud, it broke my heart. "The fire and the wood are here, Father, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" What do I say? What do you say to your 15-year-old son knowing that he's about to die? Doesn't he know that something unusual is taking place? Or does he simply trust me? I think that's when it happened. I think that's when I turned the corner in the struggle that had been going on between me and God for now over 2 days. For you see, before I could answer Isaac's question, I knew that I had to decide. I had to decide if I truly trust God. I want to tell you what happened in my mind at that point. A New Testament writer, writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, I think captures it most succinctly. He wrote this: "By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, 'It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned.'" How could both be true? Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead. And figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. Yes, the New Testament writer captured it well. My thoughts were something like this. I thought, God is not a liar. And God cannot be mistaken. He told me beyond question that I would have a son. And there that son is, asking a question of me. He's right here, in my face, the very son that God had promised. And God had said that this son, this one before me, would be the one through whom all of the promises would be fulfilled. Therefore, that son must live, or God is a liar. And yet God commands that I put him to death. Now, humanly speaking, that's a contradiction. He must live in order to fulfill the promises that God has made, and yet God tells me to kill him. Humanly speaking, that's a contradiction, but I know something as a foundational fact. There is no contradiction in God. There is power, there is wisdom, there is glory, there is majesty, but there is no contradiction. What then is to be done with the command to kill the son? Since there is no contradiction in God, there is only one answer that my mind can fathom. God is going to perform a miracle. If necessary, God will raise my son from the dead. Now, doubt may say that is foolish, because up until that time, no resurrection had ever occurred in the world. But that doesn't make any difference. A resurrection is compatible with the nature of God, but a contradiction is not. For God is the God of life. He's the God who created the universe, including all human beings, and therefore to bring life back to a dead body is not incompatible with God. So the one clear logical conclusion is that God can do whatever it takes to keep his promises, even raising Isaac from the dead if that is necessary. And in that moment, I knew what my action would be. I would obey God. Why? Because I trust him. No matter what, I trust him. I knew that no matter how painful the process, I knew no matter how deep the valley, I knew no matter how high the cost, God would be faithful to his promises. Many years later, Jeremiah added some words to that concept that makes it so beautiful. He said, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future." That's God's promise. I did not know what God would do, but I knew that God would be faithful to his word. And so I said to my son, my only son, Isaac, whom I loved, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering. Even as I said it, I did not know what shape that would take, but I knew my God. Again, we walked on in silence. And though my mind was settled, my heart still ached within me. And we finally got to the place, the exact place, where God told me to build the altar, and I built it. And then I arranged the wood from Isaac on top of the altar. And all this time, Isaac is watching and waiting. I'm the one who had said God would provide the lamb. And then think about it. Unbelievable as it sounds, this 15, 16-year-old, healthy, lively son of mine allows me to bind him and to place him on top of the wood on the altar. His trust of me was of the same kind as my trust of my father. I also knew then that the test of true faith is obedience. I could say I trust God, but until I put it into action, they're just words. And so with my mind fixed on God and my heart still in my throat, I picked up the knife to slay my son. If ever there was a moment in time that stood still, it was that moment. All of the doubts rushed back into my head. All of the reasons why I could not possibly go through with this came to me again, but with those thoughts and with those doubts also by God's grace came a renewed conviction that my God is faithful. And as I swung that knife downward, I spiritually and mentally collapsed into the arms of God. God, he's yours. Take care of my son, God. What has God asked you to do that you're not certain you trust him with or for? Has God prodded you a dozen times to confess your need for him and to turn your life over to him, to ask him for his forgiveness and to follow Christ, whatever it may mean, but you aren't sure you trust God? You fear that he will ask you to give up something far greater than what he could possibly give you? You don't trust him? Has God asked you to change the way you spend your money or you earn your money or how you use your time, but you aren't certain that God's plan for your life is better than your plan for your life? You don't know if you can trust Him with it? Has God asked you to reorient your entire life to make it your life's aim to love Him and serve Him and give yourself to expanding His kingdom, but you have not given Him your time and your energies because you are pursuing other goals because you don't trust Him? What is it for you? Has God maybe for years been prodding you about your life, your goals, your money, your giving, your relationships, your commitment to Him, and time again you've been ducking Him because you aren't convinced He knows what He's talking about or He has your best interests in mind? But again, God comes to you today, even through my story, and says to you, I love you. Trust me. Trust me. As I said, with my mind fixed on God, and yet my heart and my throat, I raised that knife and I started downward to slay my son. And at that very second, mind you, not a second earlier, at that very second, the angel of the Lord called out, Abraham, Abraham! Now believe me, my arm would not have stopped any quicker if some strong man had grabbed it. It could not have stopped any quicker under any other circumstances. And I quickly responded as I had twice before already. Here I am. What do you want me to do? I'll gladly do anything except what I'm right now in the middle of doing. And I heard the sweetest words ever spoken. Do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him. And the relief that swept over me is absolutely indescribable. And then God told me what this whole experience had been about. This is what He said. Now, I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. You know, when Moses retold this story later on and wrote it down for his readers, right at the very beginning, he told his readers what the experience was about. But of course, I didn't know it at the time. This is what Moses wrote. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. Those who read the story know that's what's going on, but I didn't know it at the time. But now remember the difference between a test and a temptation. A temptation is to entice us to fail. God never tempts us. A test is to push us to greater faith. God tests us. And God wanted to take me to the next level of trust. To trust not just in what would happen, but to trust solely in Him. He wanted to take me to that next level where trusting Him might even defy human logic. It might defy common sense. It might even force me to choose in my own thinking between my love for my son and my commitment to Almighty God. Jesus said it this way, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And I submit to you that there is coming a time in your life, if you haven't already experienced it, when all you will have to go on is God's Word. Humanly unverifiable. And you'll be asked to trust Him and Him alone. In fact, if we stopped and realized it, that is true of life every minute of every day. Do we trust Him? I must tell you how the story ended. No sooner did God stop me, and then I looked up and I saw a lamb, if you will, that was caught by its horns in a thick bush nearby. I quickly took hold of that ram and I sacrificed it on the altar instead of my son. You remember the words that I had said to my son in faith when we were walking up to the mountain? I said, God will provide the lamb. Well, I was so overcome with joy at what was just taking place that I named the mountain that very thing, Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide. I learned a huge lesson that day. Truly, God can be trusted in any and every situation. What God calls us to do, God will provide. His plans for us are good, even when the way seems evil. God saw my obedience as evidence of my faith, real faith, raw faith, faith based ultimately on God's Word, faith in the unseeable, faith in God even in the face of unreasonable. You see, what God was doing was recreating a man who would live in humble dependence on God alone. God was taking out of me all the rebellion, all of the self-sufficiency, all of the self-service that is in every one of us, and recreating a man who would trust God in every circumstance of life, even a man who would follow God blindly. I come back to my question with which I began. What's the hardest thing you've ever done in your life? What's the hardest thing you will ever do in your life? Will you trust God? He is faithful. I know it. Pray with me, please.